here to present to us the value and virtue of this particular bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is really exciting stuff. I want you to pay particular attention because this is some fun stuff.
Right.
Actually, it's a fairly simple bill.
Mr. Chairman, who is this man?
Uh-oh.
I apologize. I'm John Mabry, House District 59, formerly King of the Dalles, but that title went away. This bill truly is a housekeeping measure. Back in 1995, this legislative assembly passed legislation that would allow special districts to provide their own law enforcement on their own. Prior to that time, they'd had to do that. They'd done that, but they'd done it through a contract with either the sheriff's officer or local police. So in 1995, it was authorized that they could provide their own funding. However, a little-known statute, language in a statute that reads, a district may construct, maintain, and operate only those services, facilities specified in ORS 451.010, which were authorized upon formation, existing statute. Black Butte Ranch is the special district in question. They had not provided their own law enforcement, which were authorized upon their formation. They had done it through a contract with the sheriff's office. So this is only fixing that so that they may continue doing what they've been doing all along, which is provide their own law enforcement. This does not diminish law enforcement. Their officers have to go through the same training as local law enforcement and those kind of things. It's just taking out or correcting that little glitch in the law that says it had to be from their inception. And that's it. It passed, I want to say unanimously in the House. I wouldn't swear to that in a court of law, but I believe it did. I don't remember.
But close enough for government work.
Enough for government work. So.
All right. Any questions of Representative Mabry? Now is your time to take your shots at him.
Just one, Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
Representative, are we authorizing them to ride on horseback and carry six shooters and cowboy hats?
I would certainly hope so. Did you have a particular problem with that, Senator?
No.
And I apologize for my informality. I should have said, Mr. Chair, Senator Walker. I hope so.
All right.
Okay. Thank you
anybody
for your courtesy.
Does anybody have a problem with the bill? Anybody out there want to testify on this thing? Do a little work session.
Mr. Chairman, I would move House Bill 2784 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Ted Perriori.
Arrived early today.
You arrived early and did me a great favor with his presence. Has moved House Bill 2784 unamended to the floor of the Senate for the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? There is none. Passes. And Senator, who wants to carry this?
It's a green file, which means it belongs to the Senator.
Chairman, I'd be honored to play.
Senator Ted Perriori.
Worthy piece of legislation.
A gentleman with more land mass than any other senator would like to carry that bill. Okay. House Bill 2115. Counsel, what is this bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2115. This files at the request of Attorney General Hardy Myers and allows the state to use a psychologist rather than a psychiatrist to examine the person who has raised a defense of extreme emotional disturbance. Our request the defendant who intended to call an expert witness for the purposes of raising the defense of diminished capacity to file written notice. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, currently if the defendant raises a defense of mental disease or defect, the state has the option of having the defendant evaluated by either a psychiatrist or psychologist. This would make it similar for raising the similar defense of extreme emotional disturbance, usually of mitigation. Chairman of the committee, this bill was worked out between the Attorney General's office and the OCDLA in the House side concerning the second part of the bill requiring a defendant who intends to call an expert witness for the purpose of raising the defense of diminished capacity to file written notice. I see that Mr. Fussner is here from the Attorney General's office.
All right. And while we're doing it, Mr. Fussner, you can go ahead and come up. Committee, we're not going to be here at 6:15, by the way. the request of the parties interested in it. It's been pulled from the agenda.
Okay.
Fussner.
Chair Minnis, members of the committee, my name is Jonathan Fussner. I'm the attorney in charge of criminal appeals in the Oregon Department of Justice. And very briefly, I'm here simply to explain that in every other case where a mental disease arises in the criminal law system and where the state is afforded the right to have the criminal defendant psychiatrically examined, the statute enables the state to use either a psychiatrist or a psychologist. The one exception is ORS 163-118, which is the extreme emotional disturbance defense that reduces a murder charge to manslaughter if the defendant acted under extreme emotional disturbance. I believe that it was simply an oversight at some point, that that's the only statute that says that the state can use a licensed psychiatrist, but it doesn't mention psychologist. The reason this matters is that in some parts of the state, it is rather difficult to obtain the services of psychiatrists. There are more readily available psychologists in some of these communities. Specifically in Umatilla County, that's how this bill came about. Chris Brower, the district attorney there, had a murder case with an EED defense and was eventually unable to find a psychiatrist that the county could afford to pay and who would come to Umatilla County, examine the defendant, and testify for the state. So in my view, what this bill does is it simply brings the extreme emotional disturbance defense into conformity with all the other mental defenses that we have and adds a certain amount of flexibility to the system. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Fussner, how many other states allow psychologists to do similar work? Do you?
Mr. Chair, I don't know. I haven't looked into that. Sorry.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Walker.
I have a question. I'm a little bit disturbed by this. And Mr. Taylor indicated the criminal defense lawyers and the AG's office worked out this issue, but I just have a concern if you're talking about murder cases that you're relying on the testimony of a psychologist and not a psychiatrist. And while I appreciate and value both of them, it just seems to me in a murder case you would want to go with the one who has more training and more credentials. What, can you just address that concern?
Mr. Chair and Senator Walker, yes. There are a couple of responses I'd make to that. The first is that the Legislative Assembly has consistently viewed licensed psychologists and psychiatrists as equivalent in the murder context. When a mental disease or defect defense is raised as such, that would provide a complete defense to a murder charge. If proven, the defendant would not be convicted but would be found guilty except for insanity and committed to the Psychiatric Security Review Board's jurisdiction. There, psychologists or psychiatrists can testify. Similarly, when we have what we call the defense of diminished capacity or partial responsibility in, for example, an intentional murder prosecution, if the defendant can show because of a mental disease or defect that he did not form the intent necessary for an intentional murder, he can be acquitted or perhaps convicted of a lesser charge like negligent homicide. There, too, the determination has been made that psychologists and psychiatrists are equally able to assist the jury. And that's really ultimately what they're there to do, is to simply provide assistance to the jurors in understanding what's going on with these defendants. So without getting into any kind of attempt to make comparisons between psychiatrists and psychologists, which I'm not really qualified to do, I think that the legislature has consistently viewed them as both capable in murder cases. The other point that I might make is that, of course, this bill does not prohibit the use of psychiatrists. And if either side thinks that a psychiatrist has better training, better insight, and that side can find one and pay for one to do the evaluation and testify, they're probably going to do that. This simply enables parties, specifically the state, to use either one, depending on who's available and what the party, what the state can afford. I might mention also that one of the things that District Attorney Brower ran into when he attempted to find psychiatrists to come and testify in this murder case was that many of them said, well, I'm a psychiatrist. My primary function is psychotherapy and treatment. When what you need is an evaluation, what you really want is a clinical psychologist, somebody whose job it is to perform these evaluations, administer the tests, and testify in court about what they found. And so even psychiatrists, I think, view the psychologists in many cases as certainly equally skillful.
All right. And I assume that there's a... What kind of credentialing goes on with a particular psychologist? I mean, I assume there's a lot of concern about a person's background or experience or their ability to make the determination.
My understanding is that they are licensed by the state and they need to have a certain level of college and post-college training.
Right. But if you're prosecuting a murder case, you're involved in one of these negotiations, I mean, just because somebody has a PhD or, you know, is a licensed psychologist doesn't automatically make them credible in court. Or are you not rather looking for someone with background and credibility in forensic psychology or who's done these kind of evaluations before?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that's exactly correct, and that's one of the reasons why I think the real test of whether a psychiatrist or a psychologist is more capable doesn't come from looking at their credentials. It comes from evaluating them in a trial setting where the jury is going to see them respond to exactly those kinds of questions. How many times have they done these kinds of evaluations? And simply, how credible are they when they defend their analysis? And I'm sure we're all familiar with any number of criminal trials where the experts battle it out. And it's ultimately up to the jurors to decide whether the psychiatrist or psychologist has given them believable, helpful testimony on either side.
Okay. Senator Walker?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out to Mr. Fussner that while both sides can still hire their own psychiatrist if they want, a lot of these murder cases are indigent defense, and they don't exactly have the kind of money to go and hire an expert, so that argument doesn't really work for those people in that situation.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Walker, I think I would respectfully disagree with you there, because it's except for the very recent major cutbacks in indigent defense funding, it has been the case that a defendant who's indigent, who's charged with murder, has always been able to hire often multiple experts at public expense as part of the constitutionally guaranteed right of representation. Not only does that include the right to an appointed attorney at public expense, but also appropriate experts. And virtually every murder case that I have looked at that had anything remotely approaching a mental disease or defect defense has had usually several defense psychologists or psychiatrists paid for by the state. And I expect, especially in murder cases, that's going to continue to happen.
All right. Thank you.
All right.
Appreciate your comments.
Great. Senator Burdick, do you have a...
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I just want to say that I think there's always confusion about psychiatrists versus psychologists, because a psychiatrist is someone who actually has to go through medical school. But I think the difference is, you know, where you would find a psychiatrist, a specialized practitioner, would be in the area of treatment, and actually in the area of evaluation, as Mr. Fussner said. I think oftentimes you find people agreeing that in the specialty area of evaluation, a psychologist may need to be qualified. If you get to the level of treatment and you need medical treatment with psychotropic drugs, then a psychiatrist is your person. But we're not talking about treatment. We're talking about assessment and evaluation. So I feel comfortable with this bill.
Okie doke. No other person testifying or signed up to testify anyway. Anybody else out there want to talk about this? No? Okay, good. Work session.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Burdick.
I move House Bill 2115 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2115 engrossed before the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion regarding the motion?
Mr. Chair, I just appreciate the opportunity to ask questions, and I feel that they were answered appropriately, and I'm satisfied with the bill.
All right, good. With that, then, the motion passes to see no debt. And let me see, who wants to carry this fine piece of legislation? You want to carry it?
I was a psychology major.
You were a psychology major? Oh, you're so dangerous. Okay, Senator Burdick will carry. All right, that's good. Let's see, what's next here? You're out of here. That one's gone, that one's gone, that one's gone. And now we have Craig Prince, who's disappeared on me. So. Hey, I just kind of spin out of control without my counsel next to me. Let's do a public hearing on 2132, which folks in the Treasurer's Office and Jeanette Holman are here. Inga and Jeanette Holman, Inga Deckard. If you want to come forward, tell us why this is a wonderful idea.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Inga Deckard with the Oregon State Treasury. This is a fairly straightforward bill. It would allow the treasurer to request through the Department of State Police fingerprint identification checks and nationwide criminal background checks on prospective employees and board and commission members that are appointed by the treasurer. Treasury currently does conduct criminal background checks on prospective employees and board and commission members. We currently use a private firm that conducts fairly comprehensive background checks. However, this firm does not have the ability to conduct either the fingerprint identification checks or the nationwide criminal background checks. The firm would have to check criminal and civil records state by state, which obviously they do not check at all 50 states. And so usually they just check one or two states depending on the applicant's history.
All right. Is that it?
Pretty much.
Okay. Jeanette, you like the bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jeanette Holman from the Division of State Lands. We like the bill. We liked it so much that we wanted to add the Division of State Lands to the bill. And the reason
you mean
that
you want to?
We did.
Hang on. You want to add? You want to put an amendment in this thing?
Yes, and those amendments are the A2 amendments.
Oh, good. We have them.
Yes, they're ready.
I thought you were going to throw me a curve.
No.
Okay.
And
okay.
This request comes out of a Secretary of State's audit of our unclaimed property program, as well as a security review by the state police. In the course of those two reviews, they suggested that having a full criminal history check of anybody dealing with our unclaimed property program should be done routinely as a matter of part of their employment application process. And the reason for this is that we have lots of fungible assets that come into the agency. We get cash, we get stock certificates, we get valuable jewels, all kinds of things that are subject to theft. The other issue that we have is potential for identity theft. Part of the process of making a claim under the program is that we require people to submit identification, and that may be in the form of driver's license information, Social Security. Well, we can't. We ask for Social Security. We can't require it. Prior residences, a number of things that is very useful if someone wants to do identity information theft.
All right, that's good. Thank you. Committee, any questions? Senator Walker?
Makes sense.
All right. Inga, do you care about the amendments?
I would support the amendments.
Thank you so much. All right. There is no more discussion, I guess.
Chair, can I ask one question before I move this amendment? I just want to know if the audit uncovered any actual events where somebody took property or...
Mr. Chair, Representative Verberti, the audit did not. We have had instances in the past where people have taken things from the agency, from that program.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Makes it all the more important. All right.
The Dash 2 amendments.
Madam Vice Chair. All right. Senator Burdick now moves the adoption of the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2132. Is there any discussion? Any objections to the adoption of the Dash 2 amendments? There's none. Boom. A2. The ones right in front of me. I don't know why they put an A in those things, but anyway.
Because it was an A gross bill.
Oh. See, this is what I get for thinking out loud. All right. You ever do that? You kind of stare at something you've known for years and go, what?
Many times.
Duh. Okay, good.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the adoption of that we approve House Bill 2132A as amended and send it to the Senate floor with due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Burdick now moves House Bill 2132. A engrossed as amended by the Senate Judiciary Committee before the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? There is no objection. Senator Starr, would you carry this for me, please?
I will do it.
Thank you. I'll get Vicki one here in a couple of minutes. Well, we're going to have a bunch of bills here soon. So. We have the illustrious cockfighting bill coming up fairly soon.
Yes,
that'll be
did.
A fun experience. 2119. Let's do the 2119 public hearing. We have one person here. Cheryl Pellegrini.
And Mr. Chair and members of the committee, while Ms. Pellegrini is coming up, this is a bill that comes to you from the Department of Justice. It would add identity theft to the Oregon Racketeering, Influence and Corrupt Organization Act, or the RICO Act. Quickly, while Cheryl's getting settled, there are predicate offenses that a prosecutor would have to prove to show that these were part of a pattern. And as you can see in the bill, if you have the bill in front of you, in ORS 166715, we have a long list of what those crimes, what crimes would constitute a predicate. We've included over the years a lot of crimes. And as you'll see in the bottom, this would add identity theft to conduct that would be included in racketeering activity.
All right. So, Pellegrini.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and thank you, Mr. Prince, for setting out the summary so well. As Mr. Prince was saying, it's the department's sense that the absence of identity theft from the RICO statutes is more a timing issue than anything else. A RICO was adopted originally in 1981. At that time, the crime of identity theft did not exist. Identity theft was not made a criminal offense until 1999. Currently, the crime of ID theft is virtually the only theft-related offense under Oregon law that's not included as a predicate offense for RICO. So we believe that the absence is not due to any legislative policy to purposely exclude the crime. It's rather just a matter of timing. Why is it necessary now? Here's what we've been seeing. Identity thieves use stolen bank account numbers, credit cards, and other stolen personal information to run up massive debts on the accounts and in the names of Oregonians without them knowing about it until it's far too late. Identity theft is a growing crisis in Oregon. The Federal Trade Commission puts out statistics every year. They have been since 1998. And they noted that in 2001, Oregon ranked seventh among the states, including D.C., for ID theft, with 1,255 people being victims of ID theft. In 2002, the number increased to 2,200. The Federal Trade Commission also has estimated that the average victim spends at least $1,000 and 2 years undoing the damage that's done by thieves. Since 1999, police and prosecutors have used the identity theft statute to pursue thieves. Identity theft is currently a Class B felony. Thank you very much. As part of a working group on identity theft, Attorney General Myers developed this particular bill after noting that there are serious gaps in current law which impede investigations and prosecutions of identity theft. We find that identity theft, for the most part, is not a crime that's committed by a single actor once. It's a mobile crime committed by a group of people in an enterprise. We find that personal information that's stolen from someone in Oregon may be sold several times across the United States and perhaps into another country and used multiple times by multiple different persons. The individual thieves purchase information, run up substantial debts unbeknownst to the victim. As I said, it's often an enterprise crime committed by a group of individuals. The purpose for this crime, it also is not a crime that is it's committed for its own benefit. We find that it's usually tied to other criminal enterprises, most notably counterfeiting and methamphetamine production distribution. Currently, civil and criminal prosecutors must bring individual actions against each participant in the enterprise, which makes it difficult to show the entire scheme. Rather, we're left with showing just individual acts. And I would also note that my section, which is the Financial Fraud and Consumer Protection section of the Department of Justice, we enforce consumer protection laws and civil RICO. Because identity theft is not in the ORICO statutes, we cannot pursue civil action against identity thieves at all. And this has severely impeded our ability to address conduct that sometimes we are better suited to address than criminal prosecutors residing in one of the individual 36 counties. Adding the crime of identity theft to ORICO will give us the authority that we need. Under ORICO, what we have traditionally done is that we have identified several individuals involved in a scheme. We have filed a lawsuit against them. We have been able to identify assets that they have purchased or acquired as a result of their unlawful activity, have been able to seize those assets, and in many instances have been able to provide important restitution to victims. We would ask you to consider this bill, and I am available. Would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
All right, any questions?
Just one.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Pellegrini, why is it that Oregon, besides these gaps in our law, is there any other reason why Oregon's become number seven on the list of victims?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I think that at least part of the reason is that Oregon driver's licenses are fairly easy to reproduce. And as a result of that, we've become fertile ground for thieves to come in, mass produce false identities and then sell them or steal the licenses or license numbers of Oregonians and then just reproduce false licenses with them.
And that raises a follow-up question. Have we done anything about that problem?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I hesitate to speak for the Department of Motor Vehicles, but I believe that they are looking at the use of additional biometrics in licenses, and I don't know if there's any legislation before this body this session that would give them the authority to use them.
If they did have it, they'd probably mess it up.
Mr. Chairman, I know that DMV does have an identity theft task force that they're working on with prosecutors. I don't think we've seen any legislation yet. I know there is a bill that would create an identity theft task force over the interim to work on this, and but we have not seen anything specifically that I know of that would deal with what Ms. Pellegrini is mentioning.
Actually, if you want to understand the definition of the word obfuscation, talk to the Department of Motor Vehicles on almost any subject. Senator Burdick.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to rack my brain, but it's my recollection that during some prison tour, we found that there were prisoners working in conjunction with some DMV activity. Is that been a problem?
Council.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that was at Coffee Creek, and that is some of the prisoners there are allowed to answer questions from DMV. So if you called DMV, it would go to them, but they definitely do not have access to any of the personal information of the drivers. And I'm sure that Mitch or Claudia would be able to answer that further, but they don't have that information.
That's correct.
See, I've always thought that DMV should be merged with the Department of State Police, but DMV has never believed that they have any kind of law enforcement function whatever, which is bizarre in my opinion. All right. Senator Ferriola.
Wasn't it rather short while ago that DMV used to sell lists of Oregon drivers?
They did, in fact.
Well, I think you've got a case of cause and effect here. You pump the information out to any and all comers. Obviously, they're going to be opportunistic in the way they use it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli, I think that in 1997 there was a the federal driver motor vehicle
motor
protection act, and that act required states to pass legislation that would make access to personal information collected by DMVs less accessible to the public. Prior to that was when DMV's information, I believe, was obtained by an individual who then posted it on the internet. Since then, DMV has passed several iterations of legislation to make personal information, the disclosure of personal information, much more restrictive or subject to much more restrictive conditions. I also misspoke myself. Identity theft is a Class C felony currently, not a Class B felony. As a final point, and following up on a comment by Mr. Prince, I would note that the Department of Justice has been involved with the identity theft working group that was convened by the Department of Motor Vehicles. We informed your counterpart on the House side, Chair Williams, of this. Yesterday there was a hearing on the Identity Theft Task Force bill. So that committee is now aware that there's a group, and I think there might be an effort, perhaps by the legislature, to co-opt this working group.
Yeah. I think the banks and credit unions are getting hit so hard and so much of this stuff that they're actually, usually they'd write this stuff off, but now it's gotten to the point where it's affecting their bottom line, so they're now interested in participating in.
Yes, and Mr. Chair, they are the credit unions and the Oregon Bankers Association, the credit reporting agencies are all participants in this working group.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then Oregon, I mean, this is my personal bias, the potential penalty for identity theft, even in a C felony, is rather de minimis, I think, compared to the harm that some of these folks can impact on people's lives. But we've got some bills in the process that would allow for aggregation and some other things that would allow that. But, you know, the budget, of course, constrains our ability to do a lot of that stuff. So, you know, it's very profitable for some of these people that are skilled.
Mr. Chair, it is. At a Class C felony, it's unlikely that an individual would ever be extradited
right
back into Oregon. making it a, at least putting it in as a predicate offense would raise the likelihood that that would happen because RICO is a higher class offense.
Yeah, and then you can move into Oregon, get on the Oregon health plan, make money through identity theft, and then go to another state. Very profitable if you have absolutely no conscience whatsoever. Yeah, if you do happen to go to jail for 13 months, then you get three squares a day and clean clothes for a while, you know, while your investments in Cayman Islands are doing well. All right. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Anybody else wanting to chat about this bill?
Well, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to follow up on your comment about the banks and the credit unions because I was reading yesterday's Register Guard at breakfast this morning. I'm always a day behind, but there was quite a large article about ATM theft and the banks and the credit unions are having problems with that. And they used to just easily reimburse, and now they're wanting more showing. The showing is difficult when your card hasn't been stolen,
right,
and you haven't given your PIN number to anybody, but somebody's obviously tapped into your account by these new high-tech methods. So that is an issue.
Actually, this stuff will scare the living daylights when you get into it. I'm actually reading a book now about some of the encryption technology that that we're using in different governments, and the fellow in one of the most highly used encryption methodologies actually published it on the internet. So.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yes. The encryption codes were one of the most highly used, and the Department of Defense actually had to change a bunch of stuff because they were using it. So anyway,
wow.
Yeah. So who that said that, you know, anything created by a human can ultimately be cracked by a human or overcome? So, all right. Any heartburn on this? If not, let's have a work session if we can.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Burdick?
No amendments, so I would move.
No amendments.
I would move House Bill 2119 to the Senate floor with a DCAS recommendation.
All right, Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2119 to the floor of the Senate with a DCAS recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? There is no objection. Motion passes. Senator Walker, would you like to carry this?
Yeah, I do.
All right. Very good.
Senator Walker is our contestant.
Yeah, he's our contestant. But I have to be very careful because the senator who's in the competition has a relative who sits on this committee. So I've got to be fair. That's exactly right. We're going to now do a public hearing on House Bill 2177. And we're just going to do the public hearing on the bill today. I've decided that I want to take a look at some issues. So we'll start with Kelly's. Well, actually, Kelly, why don't you tell us what the bill does?
And Mitch's from DLC is actually the bill.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. House Bill 2177 is a House bill that's come over from the Judiciary Committee on the House side. It came over 9-0. It did have some amendments that should be in your packet. This House bill deals with a specific situation where there a judge, in looking at the current stalking orders, felt compelled when confronted with an inmate who filed a petition for a stalking order, for a temporary stalking order. The language on that says that the judge shall issue a temporary stalking order if the petition satisfies the elements of stalking. And the judge felt that the petition did so satisfy, and felt that he had to, he or she, I don't know, had to file this temporary stalking order, which then said that the corrections employee could not have any contact with this inmate. So originally, this bill would have only dealt with Department of Corrections, but it was amended in the House so that if you look at the A engrossed bill, this would say that a person who is in custody there cannot be a stalking order buyer on their behalf against a corrections person. I'm looking at the. Let me make sure I've got the right amendments here. Right. So there would be no stalking order available for you if you're in custody. if you are out of custody, you cannot get a stalking order if the person in law enforcement is acting within the scope of their official duties. That differentiation came up because there could be a situation where, say, a police officer or a corrections officer outside the scope of their duties was stalking someone, and the committee did not want to have that barred. But for the corrections environment, it's an absolute bar to stalking orders because there are other remedies within the corrections sphere to deal with if there was a employee who was doing something like stalking. So
I wouldn't be able to get a stalking order against my supervisor because he wants me to finish one of my cases, right? No.
As long as, Mr. Chairman, as long as your supervisor is acting in the scope of his or her official duties, you could not.
I couldn't. Gosh, what a tragedy. All right. I think I'm going to do a little brief recess for about 5 minutes because I need to. And
I'll be back.
Department of Corrections.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Counselor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I wanted to, there was a discussion. I wanted to let everybody know there are some A7 amendments that, to clarify, this bill came basically from Department of Corrections and was amended in the House by Department of Corrections. And the A7 amendments are not from the Department of Corrections, so I thought that the committee should hear from Department of Corrections first about the A engrossed bill, and then if you'd like, I can kind of go through the A7 amendments, which I believe Kelly Skye is here to talk about, and they come from her and Ingrid and I think Judge Legert.
All right, great. Mr. Morrow.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. With me today is Jeff Van Valkenburg from the Attorney General's Office. For the record, I'm Mitch Morrow, Assistant Director of Institutions Division with the Department of Corrections. And I'm here to provide information and support for House Bill 2177A, which was introduced at the request of the department. This bill would amend Oregon's stalking protective statutes and prohibit inmates from bringing civil or criminal stalking actions against Department of Corrections officials who are acting within the scope of their official duties. The current version of the bill affords the same protection to employees of law enforcement units and the Oregon Youth Authority. In the past 2 years, inmates have filed civil stalking actions against department officials to challenge various prison conditions and policies and or alleged misconduct by staff. In one case, a judge did issue a temporary court stalking protective order on behalf of an inmate against an assistant superintendent of security at one of our medium custody facilities. Because of the provisions of the stalking protective statutes, a temporary stalking protective order can be issued based solely on an inmate's allegations and without a hearing. Temporary stalking protective orders prevent officials from carrying out their security responsibilities within the institutions. The department believes the application of the stalking protective statutes to the environment of the state prisons is fundamentally inconsistent with the operation and management of these institutions. The availability of temporary stalking protective orders to inmates provides them with an opportunity to use the state courts to take actions against staff and intervene in the day-to-day operations and management of prisons based solely on an inmate's allegations directed towards staff. The department believes that the legislature never intended that these remedial statutes be available to state prison inmates to challenge prison conditions and policies or to seek redress for alleged misconduct by department staff. More appropriate administrative and judicial remedies remain available to inmates for these purposes within the department itself and the state and federal courts. For these reasons, the department respectfully urges the passage of House Bill 2177A. Mr. Chair, I'd follow up by, I'd continue by saying that we have not reviewed the amendments, so we have no position on those at this time, but that we are concerned about any fiscal impact the amendments might have. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. I guess we're a subcommittee at this point. So, Mr. Van Valkenburg, do you have any comments?
Chairman, as members of the committee, I don't have any comment, but I'm available to answer any questions you may have.
All right. Any questions? No questions. Counsel, you have a question.
I wanted to clarify that in the bill, you'll notice we added the term a law enforcement unit, and law enforcement unit is defined in the statute. I didn't give everyone a copy, and I should have. And law enforcement unit means any police force, tribal tribal police force, DOJ force, Department of Corrections, Lottery Commission, and any of these people that are detecting crimes and enforcing the criminal laws of the state or laws or ordinances relating to airport security. It's a very broad definition. I will note that it does not include juvenile probation officers, and I believe we'll hear testimony on from those folks.
All right. Thank you, Councilman. Thank you very much. All right, now, let's see. Who should I call next? This is kind of a potpourri of who's who in stalking. Since they're stalking the committee. Let me see. Whose amendment is the 87?
Kelly's.
Okay, Kelly, come on up here and explain yourself. Hopefully you're in a good mood today.
And, Mr. Chairman, while Kelly's getting here, I'll go through really quickly the sections because it is a little bit confusing. Under current law, you can get I think we heard this testimony. I'll just review it real quickly. You can get a stalking order in two manners, through the courts or through a police officer. Section 1 would make the claim in ORS 30, so that would be, you'd basically be creating a two-pronged system for getting redress in the civil courts. One would be for damages, which would be money damages through the civil courts. That's what Section 1 does. It bifurcates damages and a stalking protective order. Section 2 would then have the petition for a stalking protective order that goes through the court. And I'll let Ms. Sky talk to you about the way that the elements of stalking are being changed. Section 3 also then deals with the stalking protective order. I think the key to that section is that it makes the ordering of a temporary stalking order discretionary. A judge would not have to order a stalking protective order, a temporary one, which is, I think, for 30 days. And then there's a hearing, which is we call in law a show cause hearing. The respondent is served and is there to show cause why this should not be extended. Section 4 would also change the current law in that, and rather than a preponderance of evidence standard, which would be it's more likely than not that the stalking occurred, this would make it a clear and convincing standard, which is the middle standard between beyond a reasonable doubt and clear and in preponderance. This would also, on page 5 of the amendments, line 23, would give a period of time for a stalking order. Under current law, they are for a, quote, indefinite period. This would make it, the court would order it for a period of 1 to 5 years, as determined by the court, and it could still be renewed. Section 5 deals with how service occurs. I don't think, I'll have Kelly tell us if there's a substantial changes there. Section 6 then goes to the citation mode of getting a stalking order, and this just makes technical amendments to the language of how you get a stalking order from a police officer. And Section 7 also goes through that same language. And I'm going to let Kelly tell you about that one if I missed anything. Section 8 is the crime of stalking. There is a crime of stalking, and this would change the mental state to intentionally alarming or coercing another person. As we know from criminal law, that last passed bills, knowingly basically means you're aware of alarm, you're aware that you're causing it. Intentionally means it's your conscious objective to alarm the person. So that would be elevating the mental state. Section 9 talks about a violation of restraining order. I don't think that makes any substantial changes. If it does, I'm sure someone will correct me on that. And then I wanted to point out also that there is mandatory arrest for violation of a stalking order. Currently, Section 11 would keep that in place with the fact that we've got the two different ways to get it. Section 12 would give you the form of a petition for a stalking citation. This would be what would be filled out with a police officer if you wanted to get a stalking order. And I wanted to highlight one other thing. This sets a bail amount of $5,000, which currently was not a set bail. I believe that's in one of the last sections. And that's in Section 15, excuse me. And Section 16 basically just lays out what contact means, that you're not supposed to have contact. That is not changed. It also points out the definitions of alarm and coerce. Those are not changed. That just makes sure it's clear that those definitions are applied to the new sections of how to receive them. And what I wanted to point out is in Section 18, this does have the language of the original 2177 as amended. So the 2177A that Mr. Morrow and Mr. Van Valkenburg just spoke to you about, that's in Section 18. And then there's portions of this would become operative on January 1, 2004. We can go through that. But it then would also have a section that would become the corrections portion. 2177 would have an emergency clause, and that would be in effect immediately.
Okay. Thank you. Kelly.
Chairman, as members of the committee, I'm Kelly Skye with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And these amendments were prepared originally for Senate Bill 23, and I hope the members recall the public hearing on Senate Bill 23. Senate Bill 23 came out of an interim work group on the stalking law. There were a number of concerns raised from advocates and from the judiciary and from the defense bar as to the uses and potential abuses of the stalking law. I believe Ms. Swenson testified at the Senate Bill 23 hearing, and a number of materials were provided to you at that time. There's a letter that was sent to Senator Minnis from Judge Leggert. Judge Leggert, many of her concerns are incorporated in the amendments that we proposed today. The amendments that are proposed today cover a number of areas which I've outlined in my written testimony, which is handed out. What, quite frankly, I wasn't aware of that they also incorporate are a number of the changes that were proposed by Senate Bill 23. And it is some of those procedural changes that were proposed by Senate Bill 23 which will increase the fiscal on this bill. And those are issues that the Department of Corrections is very concerned about. So we actually would like an opportunity to work with the Department of Corrections to see if we can change that. And that has to do with current law allows a person to obtain or to apply for a stalking protective order either by citation from the police. They get a police officer to issue a citation to the respondent requiring them to appear in court for a hearing as to whether a stalking order should be issued. Or the person can petition directly to the circuit court. Now, in some counties, the circuit court, such as Multnomah, where I practice, the circuit court actually has forms available where the person can go in and fill them out and obtain a stalking order. One of the things that Senate Bill 23 sought to do was to allow everybody to petition directly to the circuit court and to require the circuit court to provide these forms and the packets explaining the process. The fiscal comes not only in the production of these forms, but also in the Judicial Department's belief that the availableness of these forms will increase the use of this process and substantially increase the number of hearings that take place. OCDLA's position that the stalking law is really overused and frequently abused. And the perfect example of this abuse is that the Department of Corrections brings before you today. because of the way the law is written, it's written so broadly and is written so restrictively in terms of judicial discretion that, as the Department of Corrections told you, the judge in that case felt that there was probable cause or a preponderance of the evidence, which is basically 51%. Is it more likely than not that these elements have been met? And the judge, the law says that the judge shall issue the order. The judge couldn't look at the inmate and say, this is not what the law was intended to do, and I'm not going to issue this order. The judge felt that the law said he shall issue the order, and so he did. And that's frequently the concerns that we hear raised by Judge Leggett and other judges in other counties that we've talked to. The use of this law is frequently used by people that it was not intended to cover. For example, many teenagers use this law. They get in fights at school, girls who don't like other girls, boys, you know, who don't like other boys. They come in, they present sufficient facts to a court, and the court is required to issue an order. There are a lot of neighbor disputes over pets, noise, children, property lines that are brought into court under the stalking provision. And the judges feel that their hands are tied by not having the discretion to determine whether or not they should actually issue the order. So some of the proposals that we are making is to allow the judge discretion. It'll change the language from shall issue an order to may issue an order, and the judge, even if the elements have been met, the judge can make a determination that that they don't feel that this is an appropriate case for such a stalking protective order. It's our position that that would take care of the Department of Corrections and law enforcement's concerns, because then a court would have the ability to say, no, you're an inmate in a correctional institution, I'm not going to issue a stalking order against the corrections deputy. Although we don't have an opposition to the to House Bill 2177 as originally written, and that's why it's included in these amendments as written. This will also increase the culpable mental state, as Counsel Prince mentioned. It will require intentional conduct, so that one of the concerns that was raised by some of the judges is that a person can be subjected to this permanent stalking order based on conduct that they were engaging in that they weren't intending to really scare the person. The amendments would also allow the judge to limit the lifetime of the stalking order. Currently, not only are they required to issue the stalking order, they're required to issue it for an indefinite period of time. So the teenagers who get in a fight in high school, who get the stalking order, that respondent is subject to that stalking order for life, and there's no provision in the law for a judge to remove it. Now, we are aware that some judges have taken some liberty at shortening the length of these stalking orders or terminating them, but there are many judges who feel that because there's not a provision in the statute that they cannot do that. And what we would like to do is allow for a judge to make that determination. Do they think this should be a one-year stalking order, a five-year stalking order? And then they can make that determination and issue the stalking order for the appropriate amount of time. Because of the consequences of a stalking order are so severe, we feel that it's important to increase the burden of proof that's required. It's important to remember that because this order exists forever, it follows a person around regardless of who they become and when it was issued. A violation of the order results in a criminal charge, and it also is most likely grounds for deportation if a person is not a U.S. citizen. The court, through the order, can place very severe restrictions on the respondent. It may limit the places where they may live or work or operate in the community. And again, this is an indefinite order. And it also limits the possession of firearms by the respondent. And while certainly there are cases out there where the person should be restricted from possessing firearms for an indefinite period of time, that's definitely not the situation for all people who appear and are respondents in stalking protective orders. So,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
Ms. Skye, there's a bit of a contradiction in your testimony in that on the one hand you want to limit the stalking orders, and then on the other hand you say you want to raise the bar on how you get them because they're for an indefinite period. So explain yourself, please.
Well, and you're right. I'm sort of blending my complaints about the current law with my proposals of how to change it. The complaint about the current law is that it is an indefinite period. It's a very low standard of proof, and there's no discretion for the court to modify the order as they see fit. And we do propose ways to change each of those problems with the law. If this bill were passed, the court could issue a bill for a 5-year period. They could, you know, it could be renewed if the person felt after 5 years that it was still appropriate. Frequently, it's not going to be appropriate to have it be renewed, but there's nothing that stops a person from having the order renewed. Does that answer your question, Senator Walker?
It does.
Okay.
I just wanted you to be aware of how you were testifying.
Okay. I apologize. This does allow a continuance of the hearing upon a showing of good cause, and I think that that's a concern because frequently these cases are set on a docket, you know, a number of cases, you know, maybe 20 cases are set on one judge's docket in one day. Nobody knows who's going to show up on those cases, how many witnesses they're going to bring, who's going to be represented and who's not, and there's no way to, for a judge to schedule their day or schedule their docket until the parties show up, and this would allow, if there were good cause, for a continuance of that hearing. This bill allows prevailing party to recover attorney's fees, and I apologize, perhaps Counsel Prince can answer this. I'm not sure whether the current law allows for petitioner to recover attorney's fees.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the current law, David, correct me if I'm wrong, allows the petitioner, not the respondent, to get attorney's fees.
Okay.
So this would include the respondent. The person who's being restrained would also allow, would be able to gain attorney fees if they prevail.
Thank you, Counsel Prince. The reason that we think this is important is because of the abuses that we see in the system, and even Judge Leggett, in the information she provided on Senate Bill 23, talked about the abuse of the stalking law in Dom Rel cases, where parties are very angry because of a custody dispute or a divorce proceeding that's pending, and they may do things during that period of time. This law is not limited to the one party or the other being able to seek the stalking order, and whoever basically gets there and asks for it will end up with that stalking order. And sometimes it may be the party who is not necessarily the deserving party as is intended by the law. So because there's a lot of abuse, we feel that it's important that if someone is required to hire an attorney to defend themselves against what is a very serious order, lifetime order, and that the court determines that there is no basis for the stalking order, that that person ought to be able to recover attorney's fees just the same as the petitioner if they prevail. The last concern that we were trying to address in this law is that the particular way that stalking works is a person can make allegations that meet the elements of the actual crime of stalking. The elements of the actual crime of stalking are the same as the elements that need to be proven in order to get a stalking protective order. So the way that the procedure works is a person, the respondent, is served and required to appear in court to answer whether or not they have committed the elements of a crime. And in so doing, they're placed between sort of a rock and a hard spot. They will be arrested if they don't appear in court. They need to appear in court and defend themselves from the potential issuance of a stalking protective order. But in the meantime, they are then speaking to the court about the elements of what could be charged as a crime. And many judges have struggled with this because they wonder whether they should be reading Miranda rights to these people before they're questioning them about their conduct, which could constitute the elements of a crime that could be subsequently prosecuted. And so What this bill does is include a provision that the statements that are made during that stalking hearing can't be used against them in a subsequent criminal proceeding. And that way, judges wouldn't feel that tension about questioning somebody without advising them of their rights or appointing counsel. So those are the concerns that we have, that we've tried to address. Some of the changes from Senate Bill 23 have been wrapped into this, and as I said earlier, we would like an opportunity to work on that to get the fiscal down so that this doesn't have to go to Ways and Means.
All right. Any questions of Ms. Guy? There are none. Thank you, Kelly. Paul Snyder.
Mr. Chairman,
counsel.
I wanted to correct myself. The attorney's fees, it doesn't say only if it's the prevailing party, but it's my belief that would normally be for the prevailing party. It just says that either party can get attorney's fees. So I just wanted to clarify that.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Snyder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. And our issue is the one that counsel referred to a little bit earlier this morning about juvenile counselors. We thought they were covered in the original Dan Gross bill, but having had it reviewed by juvenile department directors, they think they're not, and they should be. Children are not in the legal or physical custody of the juvenile department, so it doesn't fall under that. And they're not a law enforcement unit or parole and probation officer as those terms are defined. So we would respectfully recommend that the bill be amended to add in line 15 after the word unit a comma and the words a county juvenile department. And that would take care of our issue.
All right. Any questions of Mr. Snyder? There are none. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mary Butkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mary Bodkin. I'm here representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. An hour ago, this was a housekeeping bill that we needed to correct problems within the institution where inmates had discovered a way to eliminate the ability of the people that we represent working in those institutions to properly supervise the activities of inmates under their direct care and supervision. Now it's become a very big policy issue with the proposed amendments. We do not support the amendments in their current form. We haven't had a chance to review them word by word, but just based on the testimony previously, our union worked with the legislature to get stalking laws on the books for the protection primarily of women, but also any individual who's being stalked by someone. And I just need to say this. Stalking, by its very nature, is meant to cause fear and intimidation in its victim. That's what it's for. The way you eliminate the problem is the stalker stops stalking. And if they don't want to go to jail, if they don't want to get an order against them, then they should stop doing what they're doing. And the amendments, I think, really roll us back into a position of why bother. You know, and I just want to remind the committee that there have been people murdered as a result of stalkers, with and without weapons. And serious injuries have occurred. This is not okay. You know, Senate Bill 23 needs to either stand or fail on its own merits. This bill is necessary just for our members to do their job. And, again, this is a little housekeeping bill that just clarifies the law as it currently exists. And we're purely, you know, we're really not interested in any further amendments other than Paul Snyder's. We agree with his. We think that the whole issue of juvenile corrections and juvenile probation and parole officers must be addressed. But, you know, the other amendments really need a lot more work, and we need to be sure that the victims of the stalkers are protected over and above the rights of the stalker. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Vodkin. Any questions?
Just one, Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
Ms. Vodkin?
Oh, I'm sorry.
I should have probably asked Mr. Snyder this. You agree with his amendment. Has it been drafted yet?
Paul?
No.
Has your amendment drafted?
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. David Niebel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Niebel with the Oregon Law Center. I'm appearing today on behalf of the Oregon Alliance to End Violence Against Women. We do not have any problem with the substance of the bill as it's been presented to the committee or with Mr. Snyder's amendment. We do have substantial problems with the A7 amendments that Ms. Skye presented to the committee. I agree with the previous testimony by Ms. Bodkin that I think this would really change the nature of stalking protective proceedings from ones that a person can actually manage on their own to something that would probably require a lawyer for the petitioner to be successful in getting a stalking protective order. I think Representative Mannix, when he wrote this statute in, I think it was the 91 session, what he had in mind was broad protection for people who are victimized by this really upsetting behavior and very serious behavior. I think this would swing the pendulum from having stalking orders being fairly easy to get to being very, very difficult to obtain. We've been searching. Senate Bill 23 has been mentioned here. There is a group that met during the interim to try to develop some kind of a compromise around the issues that Ms. Skye has raised, and that proved to be very elusive. We have not been able to come to sort of a mean, some reasonable compromise to eliminate the orders that all of us would say are inappropriate, but still give victims access to a remedy that they really need. I think one of the most concerning amendments to us is the amendment that would grant broad judicial discretion in whether or not to grant one of these orders. Judges generally have discretion in cases before them to do what they want, but I think that it was the perception of the people who passed this bill or this law originally that a lot of judges simply don't get what stalking is. They don't understand the seriousness of the behavior. They might not believe that it really exists in as many cases as it actually does. And so they're more or less inclined to deny these orders in all but the most compelling cases. And I think that was the concern that led to the limitation on judicial discretion in entering these orders in the first place. I certainly can't disagree that these orders are misused. I mean, the cases that resulted in this bill being brought before you were clear miscarriages of the use of this law. That was not what was intended. Nor do I think it was intended to regulate the behavior on kids on school grounds. But I think that, and I don't know how you would do this, my impression is that the number of cases in which it's been abused is not a huge percentage of the cases that in which orders are granted. So I'm not sure how that I agree that this problem is really widespread. I think the things that stand out as real problems for advocates for victims are changing the state of mind, restricting the state of mind required to be shown to intentional, providing attorney's fees to the prevailing party, requiring a showing of clear and convincing evidence. This would be a very difficult showing for someone who is representing him or herself to meet. Limiting the duration, we discussed this in the work group that led to Senate Bill 23. We couldn't come to an agreement. The bill, the A7 amendments say that this could be renewed, but it doesn't give a standard for renewal, which I think is a concern. The discretion, I've already mentioned, the judicial discretion. So I think those are the main problems I have with the bill or with the amendments, and I think those are very substantial problems. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll conclude my testimony and try to answer any questions that you might have.
Senator Ringo.
Thank you. I apologize since I missed all the first part of this bill, and I really just want to make a comment that in my law practice, I've seen so many examples of people coming in who desperately need help but are just lost in the legal system. And, it's a real tragedy when people aren't able to wind their way through the maze of the legal system and they can't afford to hire a lawyer. And I would not want to do anything to make it more expensive or difficult for people who can't stop the lawyer. And I say that without even knowing what the background of the bill is, but I just, from personal experience in my law practice, I just see that as a huge problem.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. No other questions? Any other business before the committee? There's none. We're adjourned.